the smart money's on Harlem, and the moon is in the street, and the shadow boys are breaking all the laws, and you're east of East St. Louis, and the wind is making speeches, and the rain sounds like a round of applause.
This is Kate Manchester, publisher of Edible Santa Fe and member of Edible Communities, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is the Edible Communities Show. We'd like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch, and we've got a great show lined up for you today. Today we're going to be talking with Gretchen Hoffman. She's the communications coordinator for the American Farmland Trust, and she originally hails from Arizona. She's worked on lots of farms and CSA. She has a BA in agroecology from Prescott College, and she's working on her master's in communication. She actually works full-time for American Farmland Trust. Go Gretchen. And we'll also be talking with John Brian Hopkins today. He's the creator and the talent behind Foodimentary, or the Foodimentary guy. And if you're a Twitterer, then you probably know about his other sites. He's got Vinomentary, Greenomentary, Javamentary, Brewomentary, Cheesomentary, but Foodimentary is the biggie. So we'll be talking with him today and talking about how he got started and where he's headed. We're also going to be talking to a really interesting couple, Deirdre Heeken and Caleb Barber. Deirdre is the author of Libation, A Bitter Alchemy, and together they've written In Late Winter, We Ate Pears. Really fascinating people, great, great reads if you're a foodie. They'll be with us in the latter part of the show. They also have a restaurant in Vermont called Osteria Pane Salute, and they've been acclaimed in Bon Appetit, the Boston Globe, Travel and Leisure, Attaché. They grow most of their own produce in addition to working with local farm partners. So we're going to take a short break, and we will be right back with Gretchen Hoffman.
Late at night, when you're all alone, and the wrongs you've done me, I'll come home.
We're back. You're listening to Edible Communities on American on You're listening to Edible Communities. And hopefully Gretchen is on the line. Gretchen, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Oh, great. We're talking to Gretchen Hoffman from American Farmland Trust today. Tell us a little bit, or tell our listeners about American Farmland Trust and what your mission is.
Absolutely. Well, American Farmland Trust is a national conservation organization, and it was founded in 1980 by concerned farmers and conservationists. And the primary kind of core mission of American Farmland Trust has always been to work with farmers and ranchers and communities to protect farmland and also to plan for the future of agriculture in our communities.
This is important work. We're losing. I'm looking at your website, which is American, which is farmland.org, and it says that we're losing 1.2 million acres of farmland annually. much of it the best and most productive farmland near where most Americans live. And I imagine that, you know, we share a problem all over this country where if it's beautiful farmland, people want to live there. So I imagine a lot of this is going to real estate, no?
Absolutely. And certainly the most recent census does show how a lot of the pressure on farmland happens around the urban fringe.
Uh-huh. Tell me some of the projects that American Farmland Trust is, you know, involved in, and how are you guys making change?
Absolutely. Well, we were very engaged in the last Farm Bill cycle, working on national policy, working on a lot of the conservation elements, working with farmers to implement or work with better environmental practices on the farm, and then also working on to increase farmers' market coupon programs and increasing marketing and processing assistance and things like that to help sort of support local farms and local food systems. And then now, since the end of the Farm Bill passage last summer, we're really striking out on two big campaigns, one that focuses on agriculture and the environment, that's looking into water quality and climate change and how agriculture can play a significant and cost-effective role in improving the environment. And then also, out of that, we're now focusing on a campaign called Growing Local, which is really focused on strengthening local and regional food systems in order to have a vibrant and diverse food production system.
So I imagine that you're working with a lot of the farmers' markets organizations. I know here in New Mexico we have New Mexico Farmers Market Marketing, and they work with all the farmers' markets in the states to help them get up and running. They help implement the WIC program, the EBT, and all of that. You guys, are those the people that you're working with, people on the ground in different communities?
We are. We're working with quite a broad range, and really the way I think the Growing Local campaign fits into the broader local foods movement with farmers' markets and CSAs and those pieces is that we're really drawing the connection between the farmland and then the food. And so sort of at the heart of the Growing Local is the message of no farms, no food. And so it's not only that we need to have, you know, local food that's available, but we also really have to have the local farms as well to provide it. And so harnessing the ability of the consumer movement to help ensure the viability of the farmland.
Mm-hmm. And who funds you guys? Where do you get your, I take it you're a nonprofit?
We are.
Uh-huh.
And we are a membership organization. And I know that's a large sort of background of our funding. And then we also have a lot of support from foundations for our work as well.
So let's talk about local food by the numbers. 1,500 is the average distance in miles that food consumed in the U.S. travels before being eaten. This is a remarkable number. 75% of the apples purchased in New York City are imported from the West Coast or overseas, even though New York State produces 10 times the amount of apples consumed by New York City every year. Why is that?
Well, I think, certainly there's a lot of transportation pieces that go into that I think we'll be working through on the transportation bill as well. And it's really a matter of making it easier for people to support their local farmers and working out the accessibility and making sure that people are aware that there is a difference between the food that's grown right in their backyard in terms of, you know, being able to support their regional economies and being able to support the farmland that's there and all the benefits that apply as environmental benefits and, you know, all those different pieces that come out of that.
Now, it says in 1970 there were 340 farmers markets. I suspect there are probably more than that now. I know we've got about 58 here in New Mexico. And you guys have a contest going on called America's Favorite Farmers Market Contest. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So, and actually the number of current farmers markets, according to the most recent census, is there's well over, I think there's about 4,600 farmers markets.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so there's been a very steep kind of increase there. But we really want to see more of that. We want to see more farmers markets, more ways that consumers can really vote with their dollar and support their local farmers and help protect that farmland. And so this summer we have launched our America's Favorite Farmers Market contest. And the way it works is customers at farmers markets that have chosen to participate in the contest will be able to vote for their farmers market online and kind of build support and reach out to their friends and really take some community pride in that wonderful resource that they have in their community.
This is fantastic. So I know you can go to, can you give us the web address for that, Gretchen?
Absolutely. Customers will be able to vote for farmers markets at www.farmland.org/vote.
That's fantastic. And on there, you, you'll find an interactive map, and you can actually, there's lots, none of mine are listed in New Mexico, so I think I'm going to have to get busy and bring this to our New Mexico Farmers Market marketing folks and make sure we get our farmers markets in there so people in New Mexico can vote.
Absolutely. And on the map, there is an opportunity for customers that don't find their farmers market listed. There is a flyer that they can print out. It has a lot of the information that the farmers market managers need to participate in the contest.
Fantastic. That is fantastic. So get out there and vote for your America's Favorite Farmers Market. The farmers need your support, and local locavores need your support. Gretchen, I want to thank you for being with us today, and thank you for the work that you do. And I'd like to have you guys on again for a longer chat about some of your programs. And I also wish you the best of luck with your master's degree. So you're working full-time and schooling full-time?
Part-time school.
That's great. That's fantastic. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with John Brian Hopkins. Thanks, Heather. And this is Kate Manchester, publisher of Edible Santa Fe. You're listening to the Edible Communities show on Heritage Radio Network. And we have a sponsor today. It's Hearst Ranch, and we'd like to say thank you to Hearst Ranch. And we're about to talk to John Bryant Hopkins. And John Bryant Hopkins hails from Homewood, Alabama. He's the creator of Foodimentary. He's the Foodimentary guy, and he's been posting since 2007 on Twitter, and he ranks among the top 100 leading destinations on twitter.com/foodimentary. John Bryan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi there.
How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm a little bit overwhelmed by you because you, I think you must be the hardest working guy in, definitely on Twitter. You've got not just... Not just Foodimentary, but you've got Vinomentary, which is about wine, Greenimentary, which is about, I think, all things green, and meaning sustainable green, Javamentary, of course, about coffee, Brewimentary, about beer, and Cheesimentary, of course, about cheese. So where did all of this come from?
Well, I just I got on there, and I got on Twitter early on, and I wanted to talk to people about food. And I realized that so many people would say, well, why don't you tweet about more coffee? And why don't you tweet about more vegetables? I'm a vegetarian. I don't like to talk about meat. You know, all these different venues. And the Mentory idea just came from that. I thought, well, why not? If I could be foodamentary, I could be javamentary, I can be, I'm working on now pastamentary, and just, you wouldn't believe how many people are interested in talking about different kinds of food, especially
well,
on
actually,
the
I would believe it, but I'm one of them, so. And I follow, in fact, you were early on, you were one of the first people, when I first started Twittering, you were one of the first people I started following, and I actually went to your website when I first logged on. I thought, this is really interesting, and, you know, I looked at your house online, and I was really intrigued, and then I realized you had all of this other stuff going on. I'm thinking, my God, this guy's a walking encyclopedia about food.
Oh, well, I don't know about... I don't know everything, but I wish I did.
And I also think that it's a lot of research, too, no?
It is. It's definitely, you know, I'll be honest, I'm a burnout interior designer. Wanted to find a new career. Ended up blogging for a little bit and ended up making it a full-time job after I got on Twitter. It was, you know, within a week. I had thousands of people following and interested in what I had to say, so I was very pleased to just be able to do what I had a real passion for, and I'm just surprised. Every day I wake up, I just feel it's such a privilege to get to do what I enjoy doing. So, but, yes, I'm right now looking at about 24 books, all of them that I will be reading through and marking and magazines and... It's just my life, and I think in 140 characters, that's what I tell everybody, because it's really the truth. So,
and for those of you that don't Twitter, that's what Twitter is all about. I mean, it's basically, it's sort of microblogging. It's 140 characters that you're limited to, so you need to say what you've got to say in 140 characters. And John Bryan, I know, I mean, of course, I know what foodimentary, but how would you describe it to people?
Well, I just talk about the fundamentals of food. I really just talk about, you know, famous people and what they said about food, which is very, very popular and makes it a retweetable thing. When you get on Twitter as a medium, you realize that, you know, you're there, and it's this sort of empty space where you have friends and you have all these people you followed. And I think foodimentary fills in the little bits where I'm not your friend. I don't know you personally. But I can send you some information that will make you interested and maybe interested enough in taking my information and sending it out, retweeting it, so that other people can share. And that's really where my real value is on Twitter, is that I'm one of the most retweeted people on Twitter because I know how to write what I write and make it interesting enough so that someone else would be able to then turn and send it to their friends who may not follow me. And that makes Twitter interesting. And that's why I think I'm around, is to fill that little bit so that you just, it really, I'm part of the community. I'm like the little backdrop that shows up every hour or so and comes up with one more little interesting tidbit. And if you follow all my mentories, then the whole day is full of interesting food tidbits.
And that's what it is. I mean, basically, and I actually kind of love getting your tweets, because it's basically, it's culinary facts, it's trivia, and again, you know, I'm the publisher of Edible Santa Fe, so there's lots of actually useful stuff in there, and I often get ideas for stories based on one of your facts that you put out on one of your many, one of your many tweets, I should say.
Absolutely. I mean, I really, people ask me, you know, it's like, well, where can I find all this information? And it's like, well, I've made thousands of tweets, so if you just go back and read, you'll find thousands of bits of information. It's sort of becoming a little, all my little mentories is what I call them, are really just like little Wikipedia pages of just various food facts and links and all kinds of fun different things.
That's a great way to describe it. It's a little, it's like the culinary Wikipedia. Ooh, I like that. But you also, did you start out blogging?
I did. I started out blogging as Foodimentary. I came up with the name just out of the blue. It just came to me sort of like just as an idea. I thought, well, that's a word that means something when you say it. You sort of know what it means. So when I Googled it to discover, you know, who owned it first, or it came up misspelled. I went on Yahoo. I went on all these other places, and no one had ever used the word before in any kind of medium. So I thought, well, my goodness, this is it. I mean, how often in this world do you ever get to come up with a word and just tell everybody what its definition is and own it? So I feel
that's
real
pretty great. I mean, that must be giving you the chills.
It was. It was amazing. It was goosebumps up my arms, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. You know, I wanted to do something, and it just defined itself. It was that from that moment on, I was just thrilled to death to jump right in. So immediately I started a blog and started talking about food and got every book that I could out of the library, eventually buying tons of food books and just really just delving in and wanting to know more. The good thing is I'm not a lifelong foodie. I really discovered food maybe just, you know, 10 years ago. Before then, it was just something that you would have three times a day, but nothing really special. And I really fell in love with just the whole idea of where food comes from, how important it is in our lives. I really just like food. I mean, a lot of people have these love-hate relationships with food. You know, they either have to diet all the time or it's a burdensome kind of thing. And I don't really look at it at all like that because, I just like all food. I like fattening food. I like fried food. And, you know, I like all kinds. And I don't hate any food. You know, I just am all about really just starting a dialogue about food in particular, not recipes, not anything really trendy, but just let's talk about it and let's just get it out there. And, you know, we all can remember those commercials that we saw when we were kids. The Chex commercials or whatever. And, you know, food is at every event of our life, every wedding,
yes,
everything in our life is really around food in a real way that people don't see it or think about it. And I want to talk about all those moments and all those things and be a little bit more than what you would see on a reality TV show or the Food Network, but really just fundamentally talking about it. And it's fun.
Well, and it's also on your blogs, too. We've got about a minute left before we're going to take a break. But
sure.
On your blog, actually, you've got a couple of blogs. You've got 11 Bonita Drive. You've got Foodimentary. I Tweet You Not. And then Southern?
Well, my sister's is Southern Foodette. She's
Southern
with me.
Okay. So, but you guys do recipes, and actually there are a couple of recipes that I really love. You had your nanny's squash casserole on there, which I just love, and I'm going to reveal a deep, dark secret right now, but I love any casserole that has cream of mushroom soup in it, I have to say. I'm sure I'll go down a few notches in people's book, but I don't care. I said it. I put it out there. John Bryan, we've got to take a break, but we're going to come right back and talk to you some more about what you're doing.
Okay.
Oh, Granny Mary, high all the time. Oh, Granny Mary, taking what is mine. Mother left him on his knees after 30 years more.
And we're back now with John Bryan Hopkins of Homewood, Alabama. He's the creator of Foodimentary. He's the Foodimentary guy. So, John Bryan, tell me, you're working on a new website, is that correct?
Yes, I just, well, actually, I'm working on a new website, which will be the Foodimentary website, and I hope to be up with that pretty soon, but it's in the works. But my new blog, which I'm really happy about, I just launched 2 days ago, which is called I Tweet You Not, and it's about my experiences on Twitter. I've never had a forum where I can just talk about what's going on, and, you know, I sit in front of the computer between 8 to 10 hours every single day and have been for, you know, years. So I know a lot about what's going on Twitter and love to talk about it, and I think I have a funny way of talking about it because within the last 26 hours I've had a couple of thousand people, you know, on the launch of a new blog. So I'm really proud of what's happening.
Wow.
So. And
let me ask you this. Have you figured out, I mean, are you going to post, will all of your, because you've got a lot going on here and lots of different blogs, when you launch the Foodimentary site, will all of your Venomentary, Greenomentary, you know, all of your stuff, will it live under that site?
Yes, it will. It will act really like an online newspaper. What I really want Foodimentary to be is sort of a go-to place that could be a homepage for people. It'll have all the daily tweets. The most important tweet that I have every day is the National Day in Food tweet, which always is the first thing I do in the morning, and I will announce what day of the week it is that, you know, if it's a national food holiday. And that's really one of those things that I want to have featured on the site. And all my other mentories will be on there and easy to access. And I will have most likely guest bloggers from all over the blogosphere to come in and help with the other mentory blogs whenever they, you know, come to the page.
So, so everything will live under the Foodimentary.
Yeah, and then I'll have a funny section, which is where I Tweet You Not will be. I'll have a recipe section, which is what my sister's blog, which is Southern Foodette. She loves recipes. She's just a really good little cook, and I really gave her the whole idea of trying to get out there and share all of her recipes and the family recipes and things that she loves to cook all the time. And she's actually a pretty good writer, so I've got her involved, and you know, I hope to just sort of create this own little community of foodies, all based on and what came from Twitter. I mean, I have to say that I was just had a couple of thousand people a day that used to go on my blog, and as soon as I hit Twitter, nowadays I communicate anywhere from 3 to 4.5 million people a day
through my
Twitter activity. So
that's amazing. So you've got that. That's how many followers you have now?
No, it's not followers. It's all about, I have, on Foodimentary, I have close to 80,000 followers.
That's amazing.
I have one thing called Foodimentary Guy, which I have over 10,000 followers. And Vegimentary, which is my vegetable, or a lot of people call it my vegetarian, but that's not really true. I just like to talk about anything that comes out of the ground. I have about 10,000 followers. In total, I have well into over 100,000 followers. And
wow,
with the retweeting, every time someone retweets, that changes the number completely. So every morning whenever I do my national holiday blog, I will be retweeted. And in that, I will communicate with about 250 to 300,000 people by the time everyone retweets it throughout the day, just that one tweet. And I'll be doing that 4 or 5 times a day. So
wow,
it really just completely changes. There's also RSS feeds, which goes to people's laptops or goes to people's phones that isn't through Twitter, that the Twitter account will go through. So it's all over the place.
This is incredible. The National Food Day, is that something that you make up every day, or is there really a National Food Day every day?
Oh, I don't make any of them up. I will be honest with you. I made one day up, and one day I'm going to reveal which one it was, and it was by accident. But, yes, there is actually several places you can go on the web or in books that have these national days. It was very popular in the 40s and 50s. To create holidays and have them pass through the state or through the government or, you know, through Congress for the sale of certain products. That it would make it look good if a certain state needed to sell oranges or something like that at a certain time of year, then you would create a certain holiday for that. So all of these are real. I don't make any of them up. They're obscure, but real.
Uh-huh.
Like, did you know that June was National Turkey Lovers Month?
No, which is so weird because it's so hard to find a darn turkey in June.
I know.
That's crazy.
It's true, and I have to go, you know, I have all these lists of all these different different days, and sometimes I have to pick between three or four, and you know, some days, there are just days that I don't like to celebrate because it's just, by the time I describe to everybody what that particular food stuff was, it wasn't worth it. So,
like
you know,
National
just,
Haggis Day or something like that.
Yeah, there's just some weird days that I'm like, no, I just am not going to go there. But it's always fun. I mean, that's what's so great is that I could always be there in the morning. I envision myself as being this entity that every morning you can get up and I'm going to be there to do my little morning tweet, and no matter what is going on, you know, there'll be a national day that you can, you know, feel good about or go find. If it's potato chip day or if it's a certain kind of cake day, I just, you know, it makes me feel good to know that I'm giving a little bit, and people seem to enjoy it and have a good time with it and share recipes and, you know, talk about food, which is fundamentally what I'm about.
So how is this all you do all day long? Because you guys, seriously, like, you have a lot going on with all of these, with your blogs. With, I mean, you can't be doing anything else but this all day.
Oh, no. I've got so many more things going on than this. You know, I'm pretty methodical. I usually, about a day in advance of every day, I wake up and I plan what my tweets are going to be. And so, you know, I only have to come up with 15 tweets a day, which, you know, is fine because I've spent years researching what I want to tweet and done the tweet already in my head, or sometimes I'll put it on a document and then just drag it on and tweet it on my computer. I'm also involved with the Alabama, this is where I'm from, of course, slow food movement, and I am in charge of the Pepper Place Farmers Market, which is one of the top farmers markets in the country. And I go there on Saturdays, so that's one of the reasons I don't tweet that much on Saturdays. And I really am interested. It seems like a very fundamental thing to be involved with, and I'm getting a real passion for it, and I hope to be writing about it in book form. So that's something I'm working on this summer.
How about an iPhone app? Any progress on an iPhone app?
I have got several in development, but the problem really seems to be that there's a lot of apps out there.
Yeah.
And I think that what I want to do is that I actually have it all developed, but I'm really waiting for the right medium, and I think with the new upgrade of the new iPhone that's out, I'll be able to do all the rudimentary things that I want to do in the new iPhone as opposed to what's out there right now.
Right,
because I always
right.
want it interesting or it'll just be redundant.
Uh-huh.
So, but, yeah, that was fun. I mean, you have to work up a framework of what you want to say and how you want to use it. And it just seemed to be a real glut of them all at one time. And I just feel like it was the thing to release. It'd be best to come up with something really interesting and something people could really use. So I'm waiting it out and seeing if this next step it's going to be better for me for Foodimentary.
So I have a question. Do you follow other foodies on Twitter, and who do you follow?
I do. I like Mark Bittman. I really like everything that he has to say. I'll be honest with you, a lot of foodies don't really talk about food.
True.
That's the thing that is always amazing to me. One of the things that is very rudimentary or very much in my language that I speak on Twitter is that it's hardly ever about me. And a lot of these foodies on there talk about or just say hello or say these things that really doesn't define who they are. I mean, even, I'm not even going to name names, but if you look at some of the major foodies that you would think, you go on there and you would actually get some information out of them that would be you know, useful. It's more about a place where they use it just like anybody else. They just say hello to their friends, or they find a link that they like, but nothing that's extremely specialized. And
right.
The one thing about Foodimentary's language and all my other Mentory languages is the fact that when I say something, I make it so you can retweet it, I make it interesting, and it's never about me. It's always about the subject that I'm talking about. And that's, you know, I direct message a bunch of people, and I've actually direct messaged very famous people, and they like what I do, but I just never bring that to the public forum on my tweets, because I just don't know if 80,000 people care if I say hello to someone out in the open.
I'm drinking coffee, right.
Yeah, when I can do that in the privacy of my own, you know, just direct message them, and no one else has to hear that.
True.
And that's just one of those language things that it's just worked for me. A lot of people do different things. I was tweeting with Guy Kawasaki earlier today about that, and, you know, he was like, well, you never talk to anyone. And I'm like, I talk to everyone all day long.
All day long.
What are you talking about?
That's right.
And it's just sort of, it's one of those, it's just a language thing. It's what I like, and it's the way I do it, and it works for me. And I just am always thrilled that there's so many people out there that seem to care. And when
I think
it's fantastic.
I think you've created something amazing.
Well, thank you.
So we are talking with John Brian Hopkins. He's the creator of Foodimentary. You can find him online at www.foodimentaryfoodfacts.blogspot.com, or you can find him at www.itweetyounot.blogspot.com. And, of course, if you're a Twitter user, Foodimentary is just one of his tweet IDs. He's also got Venomentary, Greenomentary, Javamentary, Brewomentary, Cheesomentary, and Vegimentary. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's the start.
That's great. Well, we're going to keep following you, John Brian. I really want to thank you for being here today,
sure.
And I really wish you the best of luck. And I'm a big fan of yours, and I love what you're doing, and I can't wait to see how things unfold for you. I think you've chosen, you know, you say you're not a foodie, but yeah, I think you're pretty hardcore foodie.
Oh, well, thanks a lot. I mean, I wasn't dyed in the wool, but I'm learning, so...
Well, thank you so much, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Well, you play that tarantella, all the hounds will start to roar. The boys all go to hell, and then in the Cubans at the floor. They drive along the pipeline, they tangle to their sore. They take apart their nightmares and they leave them by the door. Let me fall out of the window with confetti in my hair. Deal out jacks of bed on a blanket by the stairs. I tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. And send me off to bed forevermore. Make sure they play my theme song. I guess daisies I have to do. Just get me to New Orleans and paint shadows on the pews. Turn the spit on that pig and kick the drum and let me down. Put my clarinet beneath your bed till I get back in town. Let me fall out of the window with confetti in my hair. Deal out jacks or better on a blanket by the stairs. I tell you all my secrets, but I lie about my past. So send me off to bed forevermore. Just make sure she's all in calico and the color of a doll.
So we're back. This is Kate Manchester, publisher of Edible Santa Fe. You're listening to the Edible Communities Show on Heritage Radio Network. And we would like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch, for making this show possible. And we are joined today by Deirdre Heeken and Caleb Barbara. And Deirdre and Caleb are they are proprietors of Ostria Pane Salute. It's a boutique restaurant and wine bar in Woodstock, Vermont. And Deirdre has a love of wine. They both have a serious love of food and wine. And in Libation, it's a story about Heekin's creation of an unusual and revitalist wine archive of rare and traditional Italian varietals for their restaurant, as well as their own foray into making wine from their own land in Vermont. They're also authors of a book called In Late Winter We Ate Pears, A Year of Hunger and Love. Welcome, Deirdre and Caleb.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
So tell us, or tell our listeners, I mean, I've been reading both of your books, and I can't wait to come to Vermont so that I can eat at your restaurant, because you are both serious food lovers, and you have a reverence for food that I think is rare, and you have a way of talking about it and writing about it that's a real gift for food lovers and readers.
Thank you.
How did all of this come about? How did you guys begin this journey?
Well, it started a very long time ago, between 17 and 18 years ago. Caleb and I had an opportunity to travel abroad and live in Italy, and we went there for actually non-food-related work and experience, and it was really actually the experience of being there and living there and meeting people and eating in people's homes and in little restaurants that kind of rerouted our whole plan and our whole thinking. And that was what sent us on our merry way into the world of food and wine.
What were you guys doing? I mean, what was your original plan? I mean, did this start out as just a honeymoon, or did you plan to take the whole year and go to Italy?
Well, we went over there to join together with a fellow dancer. We were trained as modern dancers and performance improvisers at university, and we went over to form a choreography and performance troupe with a fellow dancer. And so we went over there with a whole different mindset packed for the trip. And then we promptly got blindsided by the people and the town we were living in and the culture that came with it. And, of course, it didn't really have the full backlash until we returned to the United States and immediately started missing what we had there.
But we also thought that you know, we wanted to stay as long as we could over there with this idea of going to start this dance company. And we took our honeymoon on the way, and we did end up staying there for a little over a year and came back because of some other sort of family and work obligations here back in the States. But, we'll take as much time as we can get there.
You know, it's funny because I spent a lot of time in Paris, and prior to that, I'd spent, you know, traveled through Europe, and Italy was always my favorite place because I always thought the food in Italy was truer, and somehow, I always tell people that the food in Italy is the best in all of Europe, and there's just something about the earthiness and the passion that people have for it, and I was actually a little disappointed and surprised, you know, when I went to Paris that the food wasn't better there or more on par with Italy, and I'm sure I'm going to take some heat for that, but there's something about Italians, there's something about Italy, there's just something about their love and their passion for food and wine that really, really comes through, and it's hard not to be infected with that passion, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that the you're absolutely right that there is, even today, an enormous passion in Italy among food practitioners at all levels. And for the Italians, it really begins with a devotion to their prime materials, whatever they may happen to be, from vegetables to cheeses to meats to fish. And that is I would say, the focus that provides the foundation for the way they approach things in the kitchen. And I think, though, it's also fair to say that one can find you know, the ingenuity that one finds in any peasant culture that is born out over centuries of development, like the Chinese culture or the Indian culture or any number of other culinary cultures. It's just that Italy has provided this particular filter and refinement over the centuries that has just resulted in this particular cuisine that has unusual relevance to us in the Western world.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I think there's an honesty to the cooking and the ingredients and a straightforwardness and simplicity in the flavors that make it, so, as you said, so true, Kate. I think that's a really apt description. And I think that, you know, food like that can be found in Paris. but, you know, it's like any city. I mean, you find those problems in Italian cities as well, trying to find that honest and true food. But with digging, it's there. It is there because they all go back to those same cultures of the Greeks, the Romans,
right,
and the other tribes.
And that's true. I mean, you can find this food, you know, this kind of food or this kind of food experience pretty much anywhere you go with some digging. The thing about Italy that I always found, and I've been there again and again and again, is that you can eat at a truck stop.
That's our favorite.
That's the best.
You know, that's just as amazing as at a four-star restaurant. And
yeah,
it's kind of across the board, that's always been my experience in Italy with the food. It's like I've yet to have a bad meal in Italy.
And you're right that you can find those out-of-the-way places in the middle of some stretch of highway, but the pride that is transmitted from those kitchens is just as great as the pride that you'll find coming out of the kitchens in, you know, in the most elite restaurants of Milan or Rome or Torino or Venice that are considered temples to Italian cuisine.
Right.
And that's really part of the miracle charm of eating in that country.
So we're going to take a very short break, about a 30-second break, and we'll be right back with Deirdre Heekin and Caleb Barber. This is Kate Manchester. You're listening to Edible Communities on Heritage Radio Network. We are talking to Deirdre Heekin and Caleb Barber. And Deirdre and Caleb are the authors of In Late Winter We Ate Pears. And Deirdre is the author of Libation. And although I suspect Caleb probably had some input on that book as well. And you guys, I'm looking at the pub date for Libation is June 2009. And you can, if you go to chelseagreen.com, you can find these books. And when is the pub date? They're both going to be published in June 2009, this month.
This month, tomorrow, is the official pub date.
Fantastic. That is fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit, which came first, Libation or In Winter We Ate Pears? These are such gorgeously written, I mean, and sensual books. For anybody that's a foodie, please go out and get these because this is your summer read. You're not going to want to take a break. You're going to want to lay in the hammock and drink a glass of wine and and enjoy these books.
Thanks so much, Kate. In late winter, We Ate Pears came first. It is the soft cover edition of a book that we did a few years ago. And then Libation is brand spanking new. This will be its first release, and it's in hardcover. And they really work as a, I think, as a pair. They are companions to each other and sort of speak to each other.
Mm-hmm. And what was, I mean, I know you have a serious love of wine, and I only know that after reading the book, but what was the inspiration? What was it that really kind of moved you to write this book?
Ooh, that's a very good question. I think I began looking at and writing about liqueurs first. And I started doing some work for a beautiful magazine called Gastronomica, the Journal of Food and Culture, which is published by UC Berkeley. And they have a section in the magazine called Libation. And the first piece I wrote from them is actually a piece called Bitter Alchemy, which is about the history of Rosolio, which is a digestivo in Italian culture, kind of an infused brandy. And it was my research on Rosolio and my attempts at making my first Rosolio that really set me on the path of looking at other liqueurs and then looking at wine through that same lens. And as I began to write more about the liqueurs, the wine kind of came naturally afterwards.
Hmm. Are you guys writers? You are writers now.
By default. I actually, I suppose you could say I'm trained as a writer. Mm-hmm. I did graduate work. I have an MFA in creative writing, and I, of course, thought I was going to someday write the great American novel, but have been sideswiped, like I have many other times in life, by doing something else with that writing, and that's just really been writing about food and wine and travel and our work at the restaurant.
In late winter, We Ate Pears. I mean, I don't want to call this a cookbook because it's more of a, it feels like a sort of a memoir to me, although the recipes are deeply personal and intimate. What do you call, I guess, seasonal recipes and stories from an Italian kitchen is sort of the subtitle.
Right. And it's interesting that you say that the recipes are kind of intimate. My approach to writing the recipes was to write them in a way that helped direct people's attention during the procedures of the various dishes, because I think that we have, for many years, taken instruction in many ways, in a sort of rote manner, mm-hmm. without necessarily knowing what to pay attention to and what to respond to when we are doing something like cooking. We've had the phenomenon of the set it and forget it. But if you're not paying attention and something doesn't go right, how do you know when you went wrong? And so that was kind of my approach to writing recipes, and to give people information that helped them engage in the actual process of the thing that they were trying to create. And that simply results in a better dish when people are just plugged into it more fully and tasting it, smelling it, listening to it, and watching how it cooks. And then they can respond appropriately in the process. And I think it just results in better, more personal food.
More personal food, but also in reading these recipes, and, you know, it's not often that recipes or books, and I happen to love books that do this, but it reminds me of the pleasure of food and the pleasure of cooking. And part of why I really enjoyed this book so much, In Late Winter We Ate Pears in particular, is because it really did really incited, you know, what's pleasurable about cooking. And I really did, there are a few of these recipes that I actually did do, but it made me kind of slow down. The way it's written and the thoughtfulness that goes into this really made me kind of slow down and engage in the pleasure again, because I think that that's one of the things that people miss out on. And that's one of the things that makes the Italians so wonderful and makes that culture so, and the food, because there's so much pleasure in it on every level.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think that is an essential, it can be such a great source of pleasure, cooking can. And even though so many people are focused on the food that they enjoy, I think if you're just an eater, you're kind of missing out on a whole another spectrum of experience and pleasure, which is the cooking. And I also think that it engages another set of sensibilities and ideas when you start really wrestling with the problems of where your food is going to come from and how it's going to be prepared. And you start thinking outside of your dining room, and then you start thinking outside of your kitchen, you start thinking outside of your home, and you start thinking about food as a community phenomenon, and then as a, you know, much broader global phenomenon. And I think that is an important question for everybody to be engaged in today.
I agree. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back. We've got about 5 minutes left with Deirdre Hecken and Caleb Barber.
But we never were that to each other. The choices you've made have driven me away, and I never want to see you again.
So we're back. This is Heritage Radio Network. Edible Communities Show. We're talking with Deirdre Hecken and Caleb Barber, authors of In Late Winter We Ate Pears and Libation, both books that actually come out tomorrow. You can find them at chelseagreen.com. Guys, do you have a website, or are you guys doing a book tour?
We are doing a book tour, and we have a website and a blog. The website is www.osteria, which is spelled O-S-T-E-R-I-A, Pane, P-A-N-E-A, another E, Salute, S-A-L-U-T-E.com. And the blog site is, I'm going to spell it because it's in Italian, Fuoricita. It's F-U-O-R-I-C-I-T-T-A. .blogspot.com.
Fantastic. And are you going to be doing a book tour?
We are doing a book tour. We start next week in New York City. Then later in the month, we'll be in Chicago. We are certainly doing things around Vermont and New England. We'll be in Boston and Maine. We'll be in San Francisco in September. We're hoping to catch Seattle then as well. We're going to be out in Denver, I think, in October. We're hoping to come see you in Santa Fe.
Fantastic. I'd love that.
That would be great. And we're going to be in New Orleans and Houston in November and early December.
Fantastic. I wanted to talk a little bit about the restaurant and about Vermont, because it seems like an unlikely place for given your sensibility. I can think of other places where you might have decided to land, but why did you choose Vermont?
Well, we have a long history with Vermont. Caleb grew up here in Brattleboro. My family used to come up here in the summer when my sisters and I were small for a camp. Caleb and I both went to college here in Vermont, and it was the first place that we moved back to when we came back from Italy. And when we came back from Italy, we thought, okay, we'll come back to this place that we know that feels like home, even though we're going to really miss being in Italy. And we'll just kind of get our feet on the ground. And we have stayed. It has been a very fruitful place for us to be and very like-minded to the world that we were experiencing abroad in Italy.
And we have found a culture of growers, farmers, cheesemakers that already are thinking the same kinds of thoughts we're thinking about food, sourcing local food.
Mm-hmm.
And so as our restaurant business evolved, it just became more and more, the fit became more and more natural here. So that's been a huge boon to us over time.
And that makes perfect sense to me. I know just through my own work here, through Edible and through our own community, through the Alliance, through the work that we're doing with our Farm to Restaurant and Food and Fuels program, Vermont is actually one of the communities that we look at frequently to see what's happening with the Vermont Fresh Network. You guys got it going on up there, and that makes more sense to me now that I think about it. The fit is a little bit more. It makes sense.
That yeah,
it's true. And there's also a lot of energy and excitement here among people in the restaurant business, in the farming business, because of the growing sense of connectedness that people are finding in this whole trade here, and it's also exciting to know that it's reaching outside of Vermont, that people are getting connected to other places in the surrounding states. But it's also so exciting to see things happening, for instance, through the network of the edible communities,
mm-hmm.
of how much of that same excitement is growing in other centers
everywhere,
around the country.
Everywhere. It's true. Caleb and Deirdre, we've only got a short time left, about a minute and a half. Can you... together, or can one of you guys describe perfect meal, perfect wine? What would it be?
Oh my, that's always such a tough question. I think that any meal can be perfect, whether it is a hot dog and a glass of beer, to something like braised pork belly and braised dandelion greens with a glass of a Southern Italian Pugliese wine. I think that if the intent of the person preparing the food and the intent of the eater are both in tune and, as Caleb was saying earlier, paying attention, anything that you have can be an elevated or perfect experience.
Well, this is fantastic. Deirdre Heeken and Caleb Barber, I wish you both the best of luck with your books. I do hope I get to see you here in Santa Fe, and keep doing what you're doing. You're an inspiration and really wonderful, wonderful, wonderful writing. And when I come to Vermont, I will certainly be eating at your restaurant. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Kate, and we hope to see you here in Vermont and in Santa Fe.
Thanks,
well,
Kate. It's been our pleasure.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. So you're back. This is Kate Manchester, publisher of Edible Santa Fe. I am a member of Edible Communities, and you're listening to the Edible Communities Show on Heritage Radio Network. We would like to give a big thank you to our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch. They made this show possible, and we really, really appreciate it. I'm really glad that everybody tuned in today, and I invite your comments. You can reach me personally at kate@ediblesantafe.com, and I encourage you to write in comments or in future weeks, definitely call in at the end of the show. We'd love to take questions and talk directly to you. In the next couple of weeks, we will have a couple of my fellow publishers joining the show, and they'll be taking this spot. I think we're going to rotate. I know Deborah Shapiro from Edible Green Mountains and Marla Camp of Edible Austin, both wonderful people, fabulous foodies. They should have interesting shows, so I encourage you to log in next week and give a listen and see what they've got to say, and I'll be back in about 3 weeks. And again, kate@ediblesantafe.com if you have ideas, questions, thoughts, whatever. Thanks for joining us today, and I'll be talking to you in about 3 weeks.